26 years after two hikers were viciously murdered in the Shenandoah National Park, a new book is examining the case and its focus on one man.
Julie Williams and Lolly Winans were found dead in their campsite near Skyland back in June of 1996. The case has never been solved. News 4's Paul Wagner has the story.
The murders of Julie Williams and Lolly Winans is a deeply puzzling case. The two were found in their campsite, their throats slashed. At one point in 2002, the FBI said they had their man and filed charges against Darryl Rice. But 2 years later, those charges were dropped after DNA failed to link Rice to the crime. Rice became a suspect after he was found guilty of attacking a woman in the park. In a new book titled Trailed, journalist Catherine Miles examines virtually every aspect of the case against Rice and comes away perplexed.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of the charity Paladin, which is a national stalking advocacy service, and also host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of Criminal Minds, including Criminal Minds Evolution on Paramount Plus.
I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm a casting director. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the writers, these journalists who never give up when they're pursuing a case and trying to find out what happened to victims.
And with us today to talk to us about her journalistic career is...
Hi, I'm Catherine Miles, and in addition to being a huge fangirl of this show, I'm also an investigative journalist and an environmental writer.
Awesome. Well, we are very happy to have you here. Very happy indeed. And it was a little while ago that you and I spoke, so I'm really so delighted to have this conversation. And we're going to be talking about your book, Trailed, which is just an incredible work, actually, body of work, with so many new and interesting aspects to the case. So I'm not going to describe every part of the case because I'd love to hear from you, but I highly recommend for our listeners to read the book Trailed, One Woman's Quest to Solve the Shenandoah Murders. And wow, I mean, you clearly were obsessed, first to say. You must have been, to go into so much detail, which Jim and I love details when we're talking about cases so that we really understand what went on. And what I love about it is that you did the micro, what I call talking about the specifics of a case, but you also did big picture macro. And that's where there were so many revelations for me. So I just want to thank you for this work before we dive into it. I know Lisa found the book absolutely absorbing. So I'll leave Lisa to say what she wants to say about the book.
I mean, I read this book in two sittings. I could not put it down. I want to show you. You see all these post-its and stickies and everything.
Oh, the posties. I've got the same.
Colors. Laura's are much neater than mine. But, you know, I found this just a quietly stunning book where you talk about this case. We're going to get into this case. And just about the region that I really didn't know anything about, the Shenandoah Valley. And we're going to ask you about that. And just trying to retrace the steps of these victims and retrace their lives. And you just give them such tribute in your pursuit of trying to find out who murdered these beautiful, beautiful women. Jim, what was your reaction to the book?
Well, first of all, I'm very well aware of the case. And this is certainly one of the cases that we studied deeply when I was in the behavioral analysis unit. And it's troubling. It's troubling how difficult it is when, you know, and we'll get into the circumstances of this particular case, but how troubling it is when such dynamic, wonderful people end up being killed and then nothing happens for so long. So I really appreciate, and you know, as Lisa has said before, the journalists who are dogged in pursuing these cases actually can be a tremendous asset for law enforcement and the general public. So thank you so much, Catherine, for doing this, for being so persistent and dogged and thorough.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate that. And it means a lot coming from you all, you know, and I think that the more that journalists and law enforcement officials can work together on cases and really kind of understand that we do have different skill sets to offer one another, you know, understanding, of course, that there are certain things that we as journalists can't know, especially when there are active investigations. But I really do think this idea of collaboration is something that we all really haven't explored. We tend to live in our silos and sometimes even have an adversarial relationship. And I think that's really just too bad.
Right. Well,
ultimately it's the victims that suffer, isn't it? Right. There's information that can be shared actually. And sometimes the media play a key role in solving cases and people coming forward, as Jim and I both well know. And the case specifically, let's talk about Lolly and or Laura and Julie. And I love the victimology that you did, you know, you saying that you work for them. Because that's what I say about cases as well, that, you know, I feel that it's my duty to work for the victims and to be their voice. And I just love that you put that front and center, that that's what you were doing. You felt a real duty to tell their story, but to characterize them as people, as women, and incredible women, actually, who, if their lives weren't brutally cut short, they probably would have gone on to do even more incredible things. So tell us about Julie and Lolly.
And thank you for that. That was really important to me going into this book. You know, I certainly consume my fair share of true crime, whether it's TV or podcasts or books. But one of the problems, the sort of ethical problems I have, is when we sort of lose sight of the victims or they become these flat secondary characters in favor of what can sometimes feel like real valorization of perpetrators. And so going into this project, I knew the only way that I'd be able to sort of lay my head on the pillow was knowing that I was really foregrounding Lolly and Julie and really trying to maintain their agency as much as I can. And as you said, they were utterly remarkable humans. They met in the spring of 1995 at a really progressive organization called Woods Women, which was a sort of female-centric outdoor leadership program that was created to kind of serve as a corrective to some of these other outdoor programs like Outward Bound and the National Outdoor Leadership School. Julie was there. She had first been a participant, and she was going back to get her leadership training. She was a little shy and reserved when you first met her. She had come from a fairly conservative Catholic family in a small town in Minnesota, but she was also just had this real light about her and incredible intelligence. She was a geologist by training. She was utterly dedicated to social issues and social justice work. She was fluent in Spanish and had been a translator for survivors of domestic violence who were non-native speakers. And just a real, just kind of like the person who everybody wanted to be around. Lolly arrived that same May to complete an internship requirement for her undergraduate program. She was kind of the yin to Julie's yang. She was always sort of the life of the party. She usually had a Corona in her hand. She loved the Grateful Dead. And
she reminded me of Janis Joplin. I got Janis Joplin all over the place just from the pictures and just from her vibe that you so beautifully capture. But yeah, sorry, go on.
No, she was just larger than life and outrageously funny and also really loyal. She had come from a pretty troubled childhood. She was an incest survivor and had really found herself in these outdoor programs. And by all accounts, when they met, it was just love at first sight, like some kind of Disney movie with bluebirds and stars and rainbows and everything else. And they had a really sort of enchanted summer at Woods Women where, you know, and I think we forget sometimes what it was to be queer or LGBTQ plus in the mid-1990s. There was not nearly the acceptance that we have today. And so the idea of sort of exploring a same-sex relationship or contemplating a long-term same-sex relationship was a pretty scary space. But kind of within the confines of Woods Women, they felt really safe to do that and really just had this kind of glorious summer, the summer of 95, and then decided that they would pursue a long-distance relationship, which brought some real challenges for them and was ultimately what brought them to Shenandoah in May of 1996.
How old were they at the time? Sorry, I don't know if we got their ages at this time.
Sure. So when they died in May of 1996, Lolly was 26 and Julie was 24.
And the important thing for me is, in this case in particular, is that they were very competent outdoors leaders, right? You know, I'm a big outdoors person. I know you are, Catherine, you're an expert, you know, outdoors person. And I think that's a very important thing to also say, that they were used to taking care of themselves and they were leaders in their own rights. Because think those little details can get lost. But it is important that they could go off for weeks at a time and they would have all their kit with them, etc. Also, that we talked about their ages, 26 and 24. I mean, my view is they did look much younger. And yeah, I'll give my thought around that, in that when I do a lot of outdoor stuff, whether it's, you know, climbing Kilimanjaro or mountains, and you tend to be on the land, no makeup, dressed, you know, in clothing that's appropriate, lots of people said in my photos, I look much younger too. And so I think that's another quite important fact to mention. Although they were capable and competent, looks wise, to me, they looked much younger. But I really enjoyed your characterization, the fact that, you know, Julie helped other women as well, particularly domestic violence victims. That really chimed with me. And I got a good sense of who they were. How about you, Jim?
Yeah, well, when you look at the victimology, there's a number of reasons why it's important, of course. The victimology, by looking at victimology, it reflects back on the offender. So there's a reason they picked those particular victims at that particular time and place and manner for a particular purpose. And all those choices are going to reflect back on the offender. And when we look at how they were killed, we get a sense of why they were killed. And then that can point us to who killed them. In this case, it's a real mystery. Of course, it is possible that their sexuality was a factor in this case. It is possible that they were targeted just because of that. It could be that they were targeted just because of their gender. And those possibilities are what we looked at. I know that at the time we also looked at the potential connections to the Colonial Parkway murders, because the first couple that was murdered were same-sex couple, females who were together, who were sort of, because they were in the military, they had to be out and about. They couldn't be together publicly, and that drove them to what they thought was a private place, and they were murdered there. And so I remember this being a very, very curious coincidence that these victims were in the same situation, many miles away, but also in a park setting, in a natural wooded setting, and they lost their lives similarly.
I know Laura's talked a lot about the potential similarities between these two cases, and they are significant. You know, I mean, there was national park land, right? There were other similarities, and there was also an overlap of law enforcement rangers working both cases as well, which is something that the FBI honed in again on this past summer. So I don't think we can yet dismiss the potential for connection between the two cases.
I was going to ask you, Catherine, if you could just describe the Shenandoah Valley. We have a lot of listeners who aren't in the U.S. Just describe where it is and what are some of the major landmarks nearby?
Right. And part of what's so interesting is that there are so few landmarks nearby. The Shenandoah National Park is about 2 hours southwest of Washington, D.C. That's probably the nearest landmark. And the park itself, I describe it in the book as sort of looking like a long, narrow lizard that kind of runs along the spine of the Appalachian Mountains, which are one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world. And so Shenandoah National Park, which is in this sort of central section of Virginia, a very rural section of Virginia, very sparsely populated section of Virginia. And the park itself is this long, narrow park that runs along the ridge of the mountains. It has one road that runs through it called Skyline Drive. And most visitors who go there are coming from population centers like Washington, D.C. And most of the visitors stick to this road. There's all sorts of really beautiful lookout points. There's these really wonderful resorts, lots of waterfalls and things like that. Notably, the Appalachian Trail, which is this 2,200-mile trail that runs from Georgia to Maine along the same mountain ridge, goes through Shenandoah National Park as well. So beginning in about May, there's a big influx of hikers, through hikers, that are coming through as well.
And there's a good map at the front of the book, actually, which just helps locate you as to, which, you know, thank you for including that, because it does help for those of us who haven't been there. What I would also say is that, and talking about linking, when we spoke, Kate, I didn't appreciate just how many cases had happened in Virginia. And I think what you have done is provided that insight and knowledge. And for me, I have to say, I was raging at keep hearing the term isolated incident. And I've talked about it many times. I talk about it in training and ask police not to use that term specifically when there's been a murder. But aren't there an awful lot of isolated incidents, in inverted commas, of women being brutally murdered? And I can't understand why law enforcement use that term. There's nothing reassuring about women being brutally murdered. So even if it's being said that therefore it's not a public protection issue, every woman recognizes that it's frightening when a woman is brutally murdered. One of us is killed. That's still a frightening thing. So one, I wish law enforcement would stop using it. Two, it's huge misinformation in a case when you don't really understand what's gone on. And they were saying it very early on with Lolly and Julie. Park authorities were saying this is an isolated incident. And therefore, women were put further at risk, in my opinion. And I think you make that point very plainly. And it is a really important point that we shouldn't lose. And we will go on to talk about some of the other cases. I mean, Jim, the FBI, obviously the BAU's right there in Virginia. And, you know, when I was coming there for, you know, the 3 months I was there, I had no real understanding that there were so many unsolved murders of women in very close proximity, actually. It's alarming.
It is alarming. And I think, to answer your question about why they use that terminology, I think it is some administration decision to try to keep people from getting too worried about it, keep tourism continuing and not let it kind of get out of hand. Of course, what does that do? It actually opens up people to vulnerability. It makes people more vulnerable not knowing the truth. And obviously, they can walk right into the same trap if it's there.
Well, and one of the most shocking moments for me in my research for the book is, you know, first of all, there was a young woman named Alicia Showalter Reynolds who had been murdered just outside the park about a month before Lolly and Julie had been murdered. And I think there are some significant potential similarities between those cases. But even if we subtract the fact in this virtually crime-free region of Virginia, we have one young woman in her 20s brutally murdered, and then we have two more young women in their 20s brutally murdered. For me, what was one of the hardest things to swallow was finding these confidential documents created internally by the National Park Service and the Shenandoah National Park, in which they deliberately misrepresented this not as a double murder, but first as potentially as a bear attack and then as a murder-suicide, which is beyond laughable, given that the women were bound and gagged, had their arms duct taped behind their backs, were 20 to 30 yards.
Well, it's not laughable. That's criminal. That's bullshit.
It is criminal.
It is criminal. They're blaming the victims. They're disparaging them. And they are, again, setting up a situation where other people will be incredibly vulnerable because they don't have this information.
Right. For days and days. And it was some very intrepid journalists at a newspaper called The Washington Blade, an LGBTQ newspaper, that kept hounding on this. The park made the decision to bury this story until journalists found it. And then the park made the decision again to represent this first as a bear attack, then as a murder-suicide. And it was only these journalists who kept pushing the issue that finally got the park to admit, both to park goers and to the public, that in fact, what was minimally a double murder and was potentially the work of a serial killer. And this was during one of the busiest times in the park's calendar. And again, visitors, some of whom I talked to who still feel very betrayed and very hurt by this, were never given the opportunity to make an informed decision about whether or not they should be in that region of the park.
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, it's a safety issue, isn't it? If you don't know that and you just carry on, you're a lone female camping and something happens, and you haven't been given that information. But it is unconscionable. And yes, maybe that is to keep tourism going, whatever. But in the wake of Gabby Petito, where National Park Service rangers were there and they had body-worn camera footage and they have not released them. And so I started querying more about, you know, the role of the National Park Service. Then your book comes along and I'm just reading all these really frightening things, quite frankly, down to even National Park Service recruiting from prisons and the local prison when inmates are released. That's their best recruitment day. And I'm thinking, what? You've got women, lone females going in, and many of them with histories of violence against women, and now they're wearing a uniform in a park, and you've got women being brutally murdered, and they're saying it's something else. This is just really
what
scary stuff.
Fuck?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, why is that at all acceptable?
Well, and not only that, but as multiple whistleblowing rangers told me, that they said, look, you know, the level of sort of malfeasance and blindsidedness that happens with law enforcement rangers rivals what we saw with the sex abuse scandal of priests in Boston, where rangers known to be, you know, bad actors, instead of being held to disciplinary standards, are transferred. And I detail one example of that in this particular book, of a law enforcement ranger intimately involved with this particular case, who we know harassed and intimidated witnesses, who we know walked back the time of death by days, who then was out in the Grand Canyon. And not only did he seize evidence that was not included in a warrant, when he was held accountable for that by his supervisor, he went out and bought a new lock and changed the lock on the evidence room so that his supervisor couldn't get the evidence out and return it to the rightful owner. And in exchange for all of this, he was given a lateral move to another park where he continued to serve as a law enforcement ranger and retired with a full pension and benefits. You know, and I detail other examples of this. It's an endemic problem that, again, as park goers, we all ought to be demanding justice. We all ought to be demanding safety for ourselves and for our sons and our daughters and our mothers and everyone else.
Absolutely. Unbelievable.
Could we
and that point's important. Can I just say one more thing? Because you illustrate it quite well that, you know, in the park on any given day, there can be sex offenders, paedophiles, murderers, and so on. And that's where people think the risk comes from, right? But what if someone were wearing a uniform? And I mean, Jim knows this fully well. And, you know, if someone's wearing a uniform in a position of trust, then they could get a person, a woman, to do whatever they choose to, if they have a weapon as well. So it's a huge problem. And I think, you know, your book really opened my eyes to that, of just the recruitment process, that many of the park services don't even have databases. So if there's a violent crime, they don't record it. So you can't say what the true extent is of violent crime in a park. So if this is what they do with a murder, and you've used Lottie and Julie's case as an example of saying that it was a bear attack and then a murder-suicide, how many other cases are we not hearing about because of tourism or whatever it might be, you know, image, whatever it might be? It's really alarming, actually.
It's not the first time, Laura. I mean, when there was a serial rapist who was abducting kids and raping them in Phoenix, Phoenix did not want to admit that there was a serial offender there, because just a year before they had a serial killer, you know, the baseline killers, and they just didn't want to go through that again. They made a decision to not engage the behavioral analysis unit. Luckily, and unfortunately, at the same time, there was another serial offender just outside of Phoenix, and the Mesa, Arizona police did invite us in. So what we did was we worked with the police officers in Phoenix, as well as the Mesa officers, because it turned out behaviorally it was very clear that it was two different offenders operating at the same time in a very close proximity, but in very, very different MOs and signatures. But we were then able to sort of under the table help them in Phoenix, even though from the top, from the mayor all the way down, they did not want
to even admit that there was a serial offender there. This is the most asinine, ignorant response to having somebody who's a threat in your community. Why not arm the people with the information that will help, one, keep them safe, two, capture the damn guy? Why are we so ignorant? Why do we look at dollars and not at lives?
Absolutely. Maybe public protection isn't as high a priority, and particularly when it comes to women. And I know I make that quote to you and it's recorded in the book, but that's something that I've just seen across my career, where the value of women is very low. And therefore, until we have books like this written and follow-up and accountability, your book I'm holding up, that's not going to change, is it? So we don't know how many serial killers there are. We don't know how many women are brutalized or even raped in national parks. And we're not going to know until there's data, until there's accountability, until those rangers who are bad actors are held to account.
Catherine, I really wanted to ask you, because you have seen the crime scene photos, I really wanted to tell our listeners about, without wallowing in the details, although I have so many questions, and I want to have a trigger warning right here because we're going to be talking about a horrific murder, but I wanted to ask you questions about the crime scene, and if you can sort of talk us through what happened that week in late May in 1996 when Lolly and Julie came to Shenandoah, came to go camping, kind of off the beaten trail, but not that far off, and what happened. And I need to understand, like, did they ever reconstruct, like, the movements of the killer or killers, and why did they only think there was one? Because two very healthy, strong, you know, women were overpowered. And I don't know, I just wanted to kind of dig into that with you, if you could just paint that picture on what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. So Lolly and Julie were both very prolific journal keepers. And Lolly was also a real sort of photography hobbyist. And so thanks to Lolly's camera and Lolly and Julie's journals, as well as phone calls they made from within the park that week, we can recreate their week within, some, I think, impressive level of detail. They arrived in the park about May 19th, which was a Sunday. It was brutally hot, heat wave. They, again, as I said, they had spent the school year apart. Lolly had one semester left of her undergraduate degree. And so this was sort of a reconnection time for them. And so they had decided to take it really slow. As you said earlier, they were incredibly skilled backcountry leaders. They were wilderness first responders. They had led multiple trips in multiple sorts of situations. They were very well versed with the rules of backcountry camping, leave no trace, things like that. So they embarked on a pretty easy breezy backpacking week, where they were really only doing about 5 miles a day, sometimes on the Appalachian Trail, sometimes off. The big mystery occurs when somehow, sometime either on or after May 25th, the two women discovered this little known trail called the Bridal Trail. And that's bridal in terms of horses and not weddings. And about a decade earlier, this trail, which is not far from the Skyland Lodge, had been used to take families and park goers on horseback riding trails. But most of these people had very little horse experience. And so crossing the one and very busy thoroughfare in the park was sort of a dangerous enterprise for people, novices on horses. And so the park rerouted their bridal trail. And this particular trail fell into total disuse, to the point that it was not even marked on multiple maps. And it was very difficult to find. It remains very difficult to find. I have been there, I don't know how many times, and I still have to kind of walk back and forth on Skyline Drive before I can find the trail. They descended about a third of a mile down the trail and followed backcountry rules, which are you don't camp on a trail and you don't camp close to a resort. So they bushwhacked about 100 yards or so through the woods, very heavily forested woods, and they set up their camp next to a stream. So standing at the trail, they were invisible to the trail. You would not have seen their tent, nor would you have seen their dog, Taj, who was with them.
And inaudible, at some point, like you probably couldn't hear them either from the trail.
Right, because I should say that that heat wave broke midweek with really torrential thunderstorms. And so the stream was also raging, which meant they probably didn't hear the perpetrator approach them at the camp. And even had they sort of verbally struggled, I don't know that someone would have heard it, even if they'd been fairly nearby. But this person or persons, we know, came with a murder kit. And in the murder kit was a roll of duct tape. Was a knife, I believe was probably a gun as well, gloves, which we were able to recover from the scene. And this person did, as you mentioned, manage to subdue both women, bound and gagged them with their own long underwear and with multiple strips of duct tape. And where this gets very chilling is we know from FBI recreations that this person really took his time, and he cut these multiple strips of duct tape, hung them, we think probably inside or on the side of the tent, very methodically, then bound the women. We believe that Lolly was killed first and probably fairly immediately. Julie, he then took about 20 yards away near the bed of the stream, sexually assaulted her, but not
with ejaculate,
with probably other objects, right? Some oils and lubrications were found in her vagina and anus, a staged vibrator that friends and family say belonged to neither woman was found at the scene. There were also some very chilling UV impressions left on Julie's sleeping bag that look like bondage straps, leather bondage straps that may have been used to bind Julie. And then eventually she also was murdered with one very decisive slit to the throat, which is how both women were killed. And then both women were found stuffed in their sleeping bags.
And that's very similar to the MO of the offender who killed the first couple in the Colonial Parkway murders. Also, to further answer your question, Lisa, when you have an offender who takes multiple victims, it's typically because they have a weapon. One of the things that we talked about in Colonial Parkway murders was the ability of this offender to control two women at the same time, athletic women, you know, women who were in the military, who were strong. And we hypothesized that part of the way that that control was gained was potentially through some type of law enforcement type disguise or profession. And so all of those things apply here as well.
It does sound like a horrific scene. I don't believe I knew all of that detail actually before. And suffice to say that you did have access to the crime scene photos, didn't you, Kate? And you found it very harrowing yourself having to look at that material. And that's the other thing, just to say that it's not easy discussing it, but you also saw it and you found it very difficult to look at Lolly and Julie in that way, because you had such a vision and understanding of these incredible women and who they were. And it took you a lot to actually have to open up the photos. But this level of detail is really important to Jim and I when thinking about a case. And I know you detailed in your book that Taj, the dog, there was a witness that said that he was struggling a little bit, firstly with the heat, but also with the ambient noise at night. So let's say that he did signal and did alert. It may well be that he'd been alerting quite a lot. And therefore, you do have a dog like Beatrice. She alerts all the time, anyone near the perimeter, you know, of my house. But if you've got the noise of water, if you've got a dog who's over alerting, they may well have heard something, or the dog may well have, but they may well have been asleep, may not have heard it themselves. But yes, to control both of them, I would imagine that one was killed first of all, but I would imagine that also that whoever it was had been watching them for some time. And I believe that you found a little area where that was possible for you to be able to see in a little area where you couldn't be seen, but you could actually see the tent And I believe, was there a cigarette butt or there's something recovered, or I might be misremembering, but can you just describe the setup?
Right. So because this is the ridge of a mountain, the trails coming off of Skyline Drive, they all descend fairly rapidly. And so as you descend on this trail, if you go past the point where Lolly and Julie turned off to bushwhack and you go down another, I don't know, again, I'm estimating here, 100, 200 yards, the trail does plateau. And it's from there and only from there that the tent would have been visible. So you would have had to pass where they were. And as you mentioned, two cigarette butts and a beer can were found there. I've never been able to have proven and substantiated to me whether or not those were completely ruled out as relevant, whether or not just exactly who they were tested against in terms of DNA, we don't know. But certainly that seems pretty telling to me that that one spot was where those were found.
And could you tell from the photos if the campsite, if there had been a fight or a struggle, or did it seem like he'd come upon them at night in their tent at night, or was there any sign of the movement?
The general consensus is that this must have happened during the day because everything was so organized. There was a little bit of chaos outside of the tent where some things were knocked over and dumped out. But I think that's because the perpetrator was going through their things afterwards. I don't think that was part of a struggle. There was a bag of food that had been dumped out. There was a roll of toilet paper that was very bloodied. Some people think it might have been used as a preliminary gag. It's not quite clear. And then as I mentioned, there's this very deliberate staging of this vibrator. You know, the two women's backpacks are very orderly, you know, stacked one on top of the other. And then right centrally located, you know, very sort of deliberately placed is this vibrator, which again, by people intimate with Lolly and Julie say did not belong to either of the women as well too. So with all of that in mind, you know, I think, again, this is a very organized crime scene and I think a very organized criminal as well.
Well, and that would totally jive with the entire, it's almost like you have a bondage type fantasy based offender here. And, you know, measuring out the exact lengths of duct tape and taking the time to display them, you know, in such a way that they may be part of the torture that's going on here. This is someone that I would believe would have, as Laura said, watched them for a time and engaged in a tremendous amount of fantasy about what he was going to do. And then took his time and played it out. Although it would never have gone as quote perfect as he would have wanted. And I think we're very safe to say, Lisa, that it's a he. This kind of violence is very typically male in origin. And, you know, the way that he killed them, although it may be something that happens a lot, it is very extreme and unnecessary. And was most likely part of his fantasy. And was he reliving other incidents like this that he had committed, or this is his ultimate fantasy to do this?
And quite unusual to bring a vibrator to a scene, an open air scene, to bring that with you. I mean, that all these things tell you it was premeditated to use that on Julie. I don't know if there was any semen that was found or whether it was she was penetrated using the vibrator, whether they can even say that, and whether it was lubricant, you know, sexual lubricant that was used.
It was lubricant that was not found at the crime scene. And again, there's also these leather restraints, these very curious leather restraints that are very particular in the indentation left that was picked up by the UV. Again, those were not found at the scene. The FBI and the National Park Service law enforcement, and I should say, whenever a violent crime happens in these national parks, it's considered the joint purview of both the National Park Service police and the FBI, although FBI pretty traditionally takes the lead in these. But analysis was done. The women, I think, listening to your show will love this. They did analyze the lubricant found in Julie against the substances that the women had with them. including bliss texts. There was a theory for a while that the women were using bliss texts as a sexual lubrication, which makes me squirm in my chair just thinking about. So, I mean, there were some levels of sort of absurdity, but regardless, none of the substances that the women had with them were the substances found during the medical examination.
Right. And the other thing about bringing a vibrator with you, you know, this foreign body insertion, I mean, the cases that I've worked, most oftentimes when that happens, yes, it can be about fantasy, but it can also be about impotence and using that foreign body on someone, particularly women, when there's impotence. And so I always ask that question. You know, we don't know whether he'd inserted his penis, whether there was penetration, but the fact that a vibrator was brought with him, yes, you could say potentially fantasy, and probably that's where most people would go. But actually, my mind would also go to there's something, maybe an erectile dysfunction or something, particularly with the level of brutality in terms of how he's killed them and the level of meticulous detail of bringing the duct tape, but it being cut specifically and bringing leather restraints. Was there a leather restraint on Julie's leg? One restraint on her leg that was...
Not found. Her legs were unbound. Some people had speculated because he had forced her to walk from the tent or he knew he was going to penetrate her. I think it's because he was going to keep these objects, right? These sort of BDSM type props. He wanted them, right? And they wanted them as part of his own sort of collection, knowing that they had been part of it. So, you know, so then of course that raises the question then, why was the vibrator left? Was it a test? Was it a calling card? Was it just he forgot it? I don't know if we know, but it certainly does seem to be staged.
Yeah, or was it a taunt?
An insult. That's the first thing I thought.
To shame them. It's a form of shame, you know, outing them. That's how I read it, of a vibrator, a sex toy, a shaming and a disrespect. Although were they both zipped up in their sleeping bags?
And they were up to the very crowns of their heads, which, you know, again, was an MO that we saw in some of there's these seven murders of women during the course of about 16 months. And one of them is that all of these women were found either wrapped in blankets that had very intricate knot work, or they were buried. Duct tape again figures in multiple of these cases as well too. So there are some similarities in these other cases in and around Shenandoah.
Yeah, and that is, it could be an indication of undoing, you know, where they're just trying to, they're undergoing some level of guilt and shame for what they did, and they're trying to undo it. It does not seem to me that it has anything to do with respect for the victims, but more to do with the fact that this person knows the nature of what they're doing and is shamed by it. And it could very well be, you know, very intrinsic to their personality.
And I would suggest that the level of detail that's gone into it, the vibrator was not left by accident. You know, they're intentioned acts. If you spend time zipping the sleeping bags up and, you know, the way that he cut the duct tape, et cetera, everything seems to be very intentioned in terms of what he's done. So I'm not sure about undoing or guilt there, but there definitely seems to be this element of wanting to shock and shame afterwards. And I think that's very significant, the way that you describe, you know, in close proximity, six women were murdered in 6 months. If you include Thelma Scroggins, and you know, that for me, given the, and what I really thought was helpful in the way that you detailed that, was that in 10 years, there had been 10 murders in that area, but within 6 months, six women murdered. And apart from Thelma Scroggins, you've got Alicia Showalter Reynolds, Anne Carolyn McDaniel, Sophia Silver. To have three of them wrapped in blankets or sleeping bags in the way that Lolly and Julie were found, that's even more significant, I would say. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, those are very consistent behaviors. And when you have somebody, look, it's either somebody who is doing all of these, or if they publicize those details, I could say it's a copycat, or it's somebody who knows those details because they're on the inside of the investigation. But I do believe that when you have such a tight grouping in terms of time and location, that the probabilities are that they are being committed by the same person.
I mean, the other side, Jim, is that if it's not one person, Virginia's got a screaming problem, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you flip it on its head, so this message of isolated incidents, it's so confounding with the evidence of just how many women are being killed. And that's not adding in all the Route 29 encounters that women
that too,
have had, right?
And I mean, also, the Colonial Parkways in Virginia and you know, and Ivanitz was a serial killer that was operating in Virginia, you know, right in the shadow of the behavioral analysis unit. So they do have a problem, but it's a problem that unfortunately they thought, I guess, they could handle without letting the public know the nature of the problem. And I think that's absolutely wrong.
You know, Catherine, as your book turns from the crime to the pursuit of the suspects, you know, Jim said, you know, I think it's safe to assume that it was a man, but that's not, some law enforcement didn't think it was a man. It was a scorned ex-girlfriend of Lolly's who somehow came after them. I mean, there are, the pursuit of these suspects just kind of blew my mind. I don't know how you
want
to go into
that. Well, that sounds to me to be ignorance, you know, and also victim blaming, and also, you know, very much like what happened to Gabby Petito. When you have somebody who doesn't have the professional training and understanding of what kind of people do this kind of crime, it's easy for them to try to project the blame onto somebody these girls knew and basically include them in the culpability. And I think that's absolutely and utterly absurd in this case.
Yeah, and happens quite a lot, especially with these LGBTQ murders. I detail another double assault that also happened just off of the Appalachian Trail involving another lesbian couple, where again, it became complete victim blaming. They assumed that because the two women were in a same-sex relationship, it must somehow have been connected to their sexuality. We see this again and again and again. And it's this, I spend a lot of time in the book talking about this notion of confirmation bias, which we all, of course, suffer from, right? That once we get an idea in our head, we filter everything that we see through that idea. And I think we see that a lot, especially in these cases involving people who belong to social minority groups, whether it's because of their sexuality or their race or their ethnicity or anything else like that. And I don't think this case is any different in that way.
Well, we really appreciate your time, Catherine. It's been really interesting. I could talk to you for hours and days. Each case that you talk about in Trailed is worthy of an episode in and of itself. And I really value what you've done, bringing it all together. And from your book, it sounds like it came at great cost to you too. And the human cost, you know, when we're researching, when we're trying to get answers, particularly with cases as brutal and violent as this, it weighs heavy on the soul. But you haven't given up, and I know that you won't give up. And that's a really important trait, and being the voice of the victims, those people who are no longer with us to tell their stories. Well, thank goodness for people like you. And as you know, on Real Crime Profile, the victim's voice is the most important part of our narrative. And all victims hold up a mirror to the perpetrators, and we try and make sense of what's gone on. But it's an incredible book. Please go out and read it. And thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Now signing out.
Real Crime Profile was created by Jim Clementi, Laura Richards, and Lisa Zambetti. Produced by Laura Richards, Lisa Zambetti, Jim Clementi, and XG Productions, and distributed by Wondery. Editing by Nick Jaworski at Podcast Monster. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba.